Hello, and welcome back to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Dan Pacella, co-founder, lead investigator, Orange County, New York Paranormal, and thank you all for tuning in. You can catch all of these episodes on any of your favorite podcast platform. There's also video versions on Facebook and on YouTube, and it's fun to see, you know, folks tuning in. It's fun to get, we got a lot of interaction on our last episode about paranormal equipment, a lot of people reaching out with questions. But if you are new to the proceedings, thank you for joining us. Please subscribe, rate, review. Even if you have been in previous episodes and you haven't had the opportunity yet, make sure to subscribe, rate, and review. New episodes every other week. If you are on Facebook and YouTube, there is also a video version of this podcast on our Facebook page, on our YouTube channel, Orange County NY Paranormal. Follow, subscribe. If you're on YouTube, ring the bell so you get notifications, because we not only put out the podcast videos on our other social media sites, but we also put our investigation videos and any other content. So if you're following the podcast, you can follow all of our adventures on all of those platforms. And it's been really appreciated. And we thank you for all of you who have followed and subscribed. So in today's episode, we have two topics, basically. I think there is a connection, actually. They do sort of connect. I want to talk about paranormal evidence and the burden of proof and what is acceptable and what isn't, different kind of evidence, and how certain things strangely seem to outweigh the other and require different levels of evidence. But before that, I want to talk about something I saw online that irked me. I don't get involved much with the paranormal community. I've stated on the channel before, there's a lot of drama there, and we try to stay out of that. But sometimes you see something and you're just like, it triggers you a little bit. And I saw it, and my first thought was, man, if I really would like to get a platform to rebuttal that. And then I'm like, wait a minute, I do have a platform. I have a podcast, so I want to talk about it here. But it was a video that someone had posted, just a vlog, and I really wanted to address it. And I won't name the person and I won't name the video out of respect for them, but I will say that they are not the only person that I've seen have this opinion. I've seen it on other channels and it's irked me just as much, but for some reason this time it got to me and I wanted to address it on this episode. So the basic gist of the video and the series of videos I've seen is that everyone should not be paranormal investigators. And the basic, now granted, not everybody should, but the basic concept of their argument is what really got on my bad side, which was basically the points where there were four of them. There's too many people doing it, so people shouldn't be doing it. But the people who did the videos, they should be doing it. Many people don't do it the right way, aka the way the people posting the videos do it. Many are doing it only for clicks, or for to get popularity or TikTok, and they're over dramatizing it and making us all look bad. I'll talk a little bit. I agree with that one a little bit. And then bad experiences with people who the folks that I'm watching these videos deem unacceptable as investigators are making it harder for them, because bad experiences make owners less likely to invite groups in. So I'm going to take those one at a time, but I think my initial thought is, who is anybody to tell anybody or to decide who should be allowed to investigate and who shouldn't? And that's really what my takeaway was. But those four basic points as to why, it just really rubbed me the wrong way. And I want to explain exactly what my problems were and are with these series of videos and vlogs that I've seen. So to start with the first one, which is there's just too many people investigating. And you know what? You want interest in the field. You want that. You don't want it to be, you know, you don't want it to be where we seclude people. It's not an exclusive. We want it to be inclusive. And it's the only way to make it more accepted in mainstream society. You wouldn't have the new innovations, the new technology, the new theories, the books, the shows, the lectures, if it wasn't for interest in the field growing. And you would also have a lot fewer folks willing to let people investigate for the paranormal if it weren't so mainstream, if the stigma was still there. And it hasn't been gone that long. I mean, 20 years ago, this was still more taboo than it is now. But because a lot of people are interested, a lot of people are doing it, it's become more mainstream. Honestly, I think the only thing there's too much of are paranormal television shows. Don't kill me. There's just so many of them. And it can be hard to differentiate the good ones from the schlock because there's so many of them. But when it comes down to folks like us and smaller investigative teams and people and like that, I think we're ignoring the fact that a little competition is a good thing. It's a good thing because a rising tide raises all boats. And if you're doing this in a professional way, and we all have our own different definitions of professional, but if you're doing this in a professional way, you can actually help other groups to gain access, to be doing it in a similar way. And without different investigators out there, and I use the word competing, even though we should all be on the same team, but there are different groups. And you know what? Without that, we'd get complacent. I mean, you know, the fact that we know there are other groups out there and other really good groups out there, it actually sharpens you. It keeps you alert. It keeps you at the forefront. You don't get complacent about the equipment. You don't want to use the same old equipment. You don't want to use the same old techniques because you know that there's other groups out there doing things that are modern, that are different, that are new. And that's actually what I feel the people who post these videos about wanting to exclude people from the field are missing. Don't watch other people's content to hate on it or to criticize it. Watch it to get better. I'll tell you, I have learned so much from the other paranormal groups that I've watched online or that we even worked with. There are things that we can all take from each other. And as a result, if we have a working relationship where we're all striving to be better, we all get better. I understand that's the real world sometimes doesn't work that way. If we all just strove to be better, the world would be a much nicer place. But in our little world, in our paranormal field, we can and should be striving to do that. So it's not that it's not that we shouldn't allow people to be investigators. It's that we should work together to make sure the people who are investigators are helping each other grow in the field. The other concept, in the videos I saw that blew me away was the fact that they're actually saying, well, people don't do it right. We've talked about this a lot on this podcast. What's the right way? Because there are 10,000 groups doing it 10,000 ways. And you cannot create standards and methodologies until we can agree on what the definitions are. And I did a whole podcast on this. If you want to go back, it's the second episode of the podcast, the second one we ever did, where I talk about the problem with making things standard and the good and the bad of maybe creating that kind of methodology. And look, I agree that not every investigator we've met, in our opinion, represents the field well. I've met a lot of people that I think to myself, oh, they're gonna make a location not allow anybody to come in anymore. But you know what? That's my opinion, and they probably thought that I suck too. So if everybody, there is no right way. Your way is the right way for you. My way is the right way for me. Who is to say? And who is to go on in front of a camera and say, nope, my way's right, and if you don't do it my way, you shouldn't be allowed to investigate? That's a bunch of crap. You have to do it in the way that fits not only your belief system, but how you want to investigate, whether you're technical, whether you're psychic medium, whether you're a combination of the two. But you can't say that people don't do something the right way when there is no right way to do it. And henceforth, if there is no right way to do it, then by definition, there is no wrong way. Now, we all, anybody who investigates paranormal, we have it in our minds what the wrong way to do it is. But again, that's not written in a book somewhere. It's written right up here in your head. So it's your standards that we have to, it's your standard you have to adhere to. And as I mentioned in that podcast episode I did, that's a double-edged sword. But it exists. And we are not going to agree on definitions anytime soon. So doing it right, well, that's up to you to do, and your definition of what doing it right is. The one thing they talk about in these these posts I've seen, is that there are a lot of people that they say doing it for the wrong reason. And they tend to all agree that the wrong reason is like doing it for clicks, and therefore over-dramatizing everything and so on. And I actually agree with that one to an extent. But the thing is, I feel that the onus is actually on the owners and the managers of locations to vet the groups to know who is coming in to investigate. Again, there are so many people who do this now, which is, again, in my opinion, not a problem. But because there are so many, owners, managers can pick and choose who they want. And they can do research. And, you know, now if you're a museum or historical and you're doing this for fundraising purposes and it's how you make some of that fiscal year happen, you can't, you know, sometimes you can't afford to be as picky, you know, especially if they can't damage anything and you keep an eye on them. But one of my favorite stories about this is from Rhea, who investigates with us. She used to be the general director of the Wayne County Museum, which was a prison museum. And she told me a story once, and I believe she actually told the story in the interview we did with her on the podcast a while ago, was that there was someone who came in and like grabbed the bars of the jail cell and were like doing like rattling them. And then the person filming, she goes, "No, I don't like that take. Let's do it again." that's someone who, in my opinion, is not doing this for the right reasons. But you have to vet. You have these locations now have a choice, and they have to start acting like they have a choice. Grapevine Farms, great at this. Seneca Falls Historical Society also does this. They want investigations, but they want the kind of people they want in those locations. And they do it by vetting. They do it by doing their research. They do it by getting to know who is coming in before they come in. Because bad experiences, and the fourth point on that was bad experiences make owners less likely. Yeah, I know. But again, it comes down to vetting. The obligation in the end is on us to be professional and represent the field well. But not everybody's going to do that. Not everybody's in it to do that. But vetting is a big part of it. And by the way, this is not something that's limited to just small groups like us. There are locations that will not allow investigators in because how major television shows have behaved when they've investigated the locations, from moving things they weren't allowed to touch to desecrating tombs. There are locations that, because of their experience with the TV shows, because they see the TV shows as the highest level of professionalism. So if they're doing that, then every other little group is probably doing the same thing. And while that is not fair, I completely get it. I completely understand if they come to that conclusion. Because if what we're representing on television as the best of the best, whether you agree with that or not, that's what it is shown to be. If they can't be held to the higher standard, then what are the, nobody's going to be. So they think we're all like that. And the way we can fight that is really by, we just have to keep putting our best foot forward. It's on us. As investigators, we have to separate ourselves, not by kicking other people out, but by being better. By being better ourselves, by being aware of what it is we're putting out there. I am shocked at what I see some people put on social media. And I sound like an old man when I say it. But I follow other groups online, on Facebook and on Instagram. And there are some amazing groups out there who do a great job with social media, way better than I do. But then I'll see them post something and there's curse words in it, or there's something inappropriate, or the punctuation is terrible, or whatever it is. So if I own a location, that's how I have to get to know the people who are trying to come in. It's how we represent ourselves. So be aware of that. You know what? Honestly, it is so worth having a website. I will tell you just from my own experience, I have had many locations say to us, you know, we weren't going to have people come in or whatever, or we don't have people come in, but we went on your website, we checked you out, and we liked what we saw. It isn't hard to make a website these days. You can do it. I mean, they're not the most dynamic websites, but having a website has absolutely helped us get into locations that we wouldn't normally get in. And it's all about just giving off that professional look from, you know, a Facebook page, Instagram, TikTok that has some professionalism to it, a nice looking website, and looking and dressing the part. I mean, I'm not a fashion plate, but you know, when we show up, we're dressed a lot pretty much the same. We're not wearing torn outfits. You know, it's all of that. It's the fact that we have to basically represent ourselves as a business, even if you aren't a business, because, you know, again, there's a lot of people doing this, and that's a good thing in my opinion. But I think the thing that one of the main things these videos are missing, when they talk about how there's so many people, and it's what we're seeing happening is now owners and managers, they're able to pick and choose now. And now it's not so matter of just calling up a location and saying, hey, we want to come in, what do you charge or whatever. They're starting to say no if they don't like what they see, and it's on us to make ourselves look presentable professionally so that they do like what they see, so that we can get different investigators into places, because it's a crowded field, but a crowded field is good regardless of what these people are saying. You shouldn't be pushing people out of it. We should be bringing the right people into it. So there you go. I feel better now. I got to rant a little bit about some of those videos that really rubbed me the wrong way, because I think it's the completely incorrect way to look at the growth of the paranormal field. We have to take what's going on and make ourselves better from it, not exclude people, in my opinion. The other thing I wanted to talk about today is we talk a lot about paranormal evidence. And last episode, we talked about paranormal equipment to gather that evidence. Well, I want to talk a little bit about the evidence itself, because what is acceptable evidence? What isn't? What kind of evidence outweighs other kinds of evidence? We do weigh evidence differently. Like I said earlier, every group has their own scale. The most I can do is tell you mine. But, you know, all paranormal evidence isn't created equal. And as I talked about in the last episode, all equipment isn't created equal either. And by the way, we're not all using the same equipment, and not every group feels that the same equipment is as valid as another group has. So we're all doing it a different way, using different stuff, and then having to grade it on a scale of acceptable or not, which again is an arbitrary scale. See the problem here? But we do weigh evidence differently. So I want to talk a little bit about how we look at evidence, how we weigh evidence, and something really interesting that we've noticed about evidence and proof in our travels over the years. So not to go back into an equipment thing, because we just spent 40 minutes in the last episode doing that, but the different types of evidence, we do weigh them. Video evidence is kind of, when it comes to IR and full spectrum, I kind of weigh it equally. It's when there's regular light photos, you're always looking for a reflection. You're always looking for headlights of a car driving by. You're always looking for a glass wall that may have reflected. That's why we don't use flash. When we do events, people use their iPhones. Sometimes they use flashes, sometimes they don't. So like any kind of phone like that is going to be something we're going to look pretty closely into. You can get a lot of false orbs and light anomalies using a regular phone with a flash in a dark room. So we actually tell people not to use a flash. Yes, you're going to have a lot of pictures on your phone that are just black, but if you want something that could potentially be good, you have to do it that way to get rid of the false positives. When it comes to the video, like I said, full spectrum IR, pretty even. They're good. That, you know, they're easy. It's sometimes pretty easy to debunk. Now everything's such high definition, and the higher definition, the better. It's pretty easy to debunk. The video that's really tricky, and the only one I really have a hard time ever saying anything conclusive about, is we get a lot of folks who send us Ring camera footage. And I'm not saying don't send it. If you see something cool and you know you want to have a paranormal group look at it, that's perfectly fine. But because of the resolution and because of the frames per second and per minute on that, it's very hard to get any kind of conclusive proof. So when it comes to video evidence with the paranormal, the higher definition, the more vivid it is, the better. Like in a Ring camera, you can't tell the difference between a bug and a light anomaly as easily as you can with a full spectrum 4K camera. And the more ways we can say what something isn't based on the quality of the footage, the more likely we are to give any kind of determination. Because if I have a shred of doubt because of the definition, I throw it out. And unfortunately, when people send us stuff, they don't always love that I have to throw it out and I won't give it a conclusive. It's just because the quality of it isn't there. It could be just about anything, especially on that kind of thing. Where the scale really comes in is audio. There are different types of audio evidence, and we do weigh them differently. EVP is king. Electronic voice phenomenon. Those are the voices that a digital recorder or a camera will pick up that we can't hear with our ears, but the equipment can. Those, you know, once you decide that it's not 100 different things that it could be, somebody breathing, somebody else whispering, somebody moving. I mean, those recorders are so sensitive, and it can be difficult to do that, but the best voices or EVPs you're going to get are going to be through those digital recorders and those cameras with those high sensitivity microphones. So EVP is definitely top rank. I would put Spirit Box second, because, you know, with that white noise, it's pretty obvious when there's something there that shouldn't be, because of the fact that it scans radio stations so quickly. If you have a message that's longer than 1/10 of a second, there's a pretty good chance that that's something that, you know, that a spirit might be using that white noise to communicate, because the radio interference is taken away because of how fast that thing scans. It's a good impression of it, you have to admit. And so that is, and then one of the pieces of equipment we use a lot. We use it a lot in investigations. We use it a lot in events. It's pretty much everyone on the team's favorite, although my favorite's the Spirit Box. And that's the Phasma Box. That's the one that uses the chopped up sound bars, allows spirits to manipulate them, to form words, to form sentences, to form answers, and so forth. And the reason it's third, and it's a valid piece of equipment. I've picked up more, you know, words on that thing, and then I get it as an EVP 2 seconds later. Like, the equipment's picking up the same words, and that just validates it. That's the only reason we use the Phasma Box, because that started happening so much. I'm like, okay, this thing's valid. But with the Phasma Box, it's in real time, and there's a lot of reverb. And sometimes you can hear what you want to. And when I'm reviewing it, that I'm really, really careful to make sure that I can actually, the word I'm saying it is the word that I'm hearing through my noise canceling headphones with the sound all turned up. Because, you know, getting a word wrong and presenting that as paranormal evidence, that can be damaging. That could be bad. There's a big difference between some words that sound alike but are different. And with the Phasma, that's why I put the Phasma Box last, because it's more prone to something that's harder to understand. EVPs, especially the Class A ones, are very clear. Spirit Box, generally during review, you're able to make it out most of the time. Phasma Box, that can be a little bit tricky. They're all valid, but I just weigh them differently in terms of, you know, how powerful of a piece of evidence it actually is. And then every other piece of equipment, from EM detectors to thermal cameras to digital cameras, quality's king. You do get what you pay for. I mean, last episode I talked about how not to break the bank to get good stuff, but EM detectors are the worst with this, because you can buy a cheap little EM detector and it picks up everything. You could walk into an Amish house and it'll pick something up. It is so sensitive. But EDI, MEL meters, and tri-field meters. Those are where the quality is king. And, you know, the K2s with the lights on them, there are cheap ones that pick up everything. And there are cheap ones who pick up nothing. You could walk into an electric transformer room, and it wouldn't do anything. So you do have to get decent on that. And there are ways to do that without breaking the bank. See the last episode. And that's true with all the equipment. The cell phone apps, like I said in the previous episode, I don't trust them. I don't weigh them very heavily because, you know, these things are purpose-built, where a cell phone app is just another thing that your phone can do all of a sudden. So, but it goes a lot further than just the equipment and weighing the evidence that we get. There's much more to the whole burden of proof than the quality and how we rank the proof. So it leads to a question that I've been asked in various forms for a long time. And that question is there pressure on investigators to always come back with evidence? Sort of. It depends what your business model is. And honestly, for a lot of locations, and you've heard me say this before on this platform, a lot of times they don't come back with anything good, whether they have evidence or whether they don't. The ownership never sees it again. It's, again, like I talked earlier, it's one of the ways that we have decided to try and separate ourselves is by doing that. And it's helped. It's definitely helped. But it depends on your business model, because our question I always ask is, are you charging? Because if you are, then there is an onus to come back with something. Because if you don't, what are they paying for? And you can agree or disagree with that take. I understand both sides of it, but that's one of the reasons we don't charge. Because I don't want to ever feel like I have to come back with something because I cashed a check. I want to come in as objectively as possible. Trust me, this is not an inexpensive hobby. It would be great to monetize some of this, and a lot of folks do. But I don't want to sacrifice the integrity of the product and the integrity of what I'm selling, quote unquote, by having you pay me, because then I feel like I have to come back with something. And would I call something paranormal that I don't 100% believe is paranormal if I'm worried that a paying customer is going to want their money back or be unhappy or feel they were ripped off? I like to think I would not, but none of us know until we're there, and I never want to put myself in a position to be there. So we've never charged, and that's why. And that's why most paranormal groups don't charge. The other thing I hear is, do you feel like you're not any good if you don't come back with anything? And I've seen that. I've seen where investigators blame themselves. And no, it sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't. It's an inexact science. Unfortunately, you know, the same kind of people who post videos saying nobody should be allowed to be an investigator from now on, there are people out there who basically say you're lousy at this if you don't come back with something, or you're terrible, you know, because the internet is such a lovely place. And the burden of proof has led people to faking evidence. And we've seen it. It usually gets exposed because, again, there are petty people out there who aren't making themselves better. They're just trying to watch everybody else's videos and prove they're wrong. And it has led to people faking evidence. And it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate. It happens. I've never done it. I never thought of doing it. I never will do it. Because there's just, when integrity is all you have, and that's all any of these us groups have in this field, the ones who aren't making any money, which is most of us, the ones that aren't on TV, which is almost all of us, all you have is your integrity. And it's not a bad thing to come back with nothing. Just because, you know, the burden of proof, it shouldn't be a burden. The proof is, is optimal. It's what you want. But I feel there's just as much credibility in going back and saying, look, we didn't get anything. I've done it a bunch of times, a lot of residential investigations, and I've been told by people I'm wrong. And what I say is, look, I say, look, you know, we didn't get anything, but it doesn't mean somebody else wouldn't. So maybe it's us, maybe, you know, so, you know, we're happy to try again, but bring in somebody else and maybe they'll have a different reaction. So It can happen. I hate to see it, but it does. But if you, you know, the pressure on you to come back as evident with evidence as an investigator really, I think, comes down to how you're setting yourself up. If you're a free service like we are, you get what you get. And the people know that they're getting what they get because we have nothing to gain. Or either way. You know, while we're talking about pressure and burden of proof, I think it's a good time to address another thing I've been asked, which is there pressure on iconic haunted locations to deliver paranormal activity? And yes, there is. And that is incredibly unfair as an expectation. People don't understand this. And I've talked to owners of these locations. And an iconic haunted location, a Hillview Manor, a Rolling Hills, a Shanley Hotel, those kind of places, they offer an increased chance of paranormal activity. But it's not a guarantee. You can't guarantee paranormal activity. You cannot guarantee it. And I've seen so many people who write reviews who even are sitting at those things that are just bored out of their minds. You know, these people think it should be like a TV show or like a haunt or like one of those haunted houses where things jump out at you. And they complain. I've heard people go to the ghost hunt events and they complain that it's boring. Apparently they didn't know what they were going for. And I think this is why you see a lot of iconic haunted locations do things like conventions and fairs, and Rolling Hills does an Easter egg hunt. Like they are on it, man. They do everything. I love it. You see them doing these things because they want to find a way to draw people to that location who aren't like us, who are, you know, because most people aren't like us. I'm sorry to tell you. Most people don't find their Saturday night enjoyment in sitting in a dark, dank hallway talking to ghosts for 8 hours a night with nothing happening around you that you can perceive. So they do. They bring in other things to get people there. And I think, you know, it's so unfair to just, you know, expect these locations to, you know, to deliver on haunted. I mean, these are spirits of human beings. These are not circus performers. They, you know, it's actually disrespectful to go in and be mad because they didn't appear that night. And you know what? You know, it just cracks me up. But I've read so many things of people mad because something didn't happen. Are you kidding me? Appreciate where you are in the moment. Because a lot of these iconic locations are also extremely historical locations. And if you're not in love with the history of the building, you know, that could affect the spirits talking to you as well. But yeah, there is pressure a lot of times, but it's completely unfair and it's completely unfounded. But just like how there shouldn't be pressure on paranormal investigators to come back with evidence all the time, it's something that exists. So the last part of what I want to talk about in terms of burden of proof is that the burden of proof is also not equal. And it always amazes me. It's something I've seen countless of times during investigations or events or in the Facebook comments or YouTube comments or Instagram comments or any emails, anytime anybody can, you know, throw shade, any forum they do that on. People question every single piece of evidence we publish, that most groups publish. They scrutinize, they explain, they excuse, they accuse us of everything. You faked this, you faked that. And as I said a few episodes ago, with AI, it's actually getting easier to fake stuff. So I'm glad people are being you know, more aware of what they're watching and they're questioning. But it's one thing to question, it's another to accuse. But the one thing that always blows me away at these events is that a psychic or a medium, when they say something, it's not questioned as much. It's interesting to me. Many managers and owners, they just, and people in general, just accept what a medium will tell them about a location as fact. No need to bag it up. No need to prove it. No need to record it. It's just true because they said it. And I've seen it. I've seen it hundreds of times where people will discard 1,000 hours of investigative footage of a location because a medium told them something. And it drives, I'm not going to lie, it drives me crazy. I respect that whole side of this. I've said before, we are a technology-based group. We are, because we do not have a medium amongst us. So we have to rely on the equipment. But it drives me nuts that I will have investigated a place a half a dozen times, and then a person walks in who has that gift or curse, depending on how you look at it, and says something, and all of that investigation in people's eyes is gone. All the evidence doesn't matter. It's all down to what that person has said. And we have to sort of ask ourselves, why is that exactly? Why does that happen? And by the way, it's not the medium's fault that it happened. Some of the nicest people we've met doing this are legitimate psychic mediums that are, you know, if you met, when you meet the legit ones, they're I always say they're creepy, which sounds like I'm a bad thing, but like, it's crazy to me how on the money some of these folks who are legit can be. But I think that's the person on that, is why it's accepted so much quicker and without a lot of questioning, because a story coming from a medium, it's more complete, it's more relatable, it's human, it's coming from a human to a human, it's emotional, it's using, you know, when I play an EVP, it's sometimes hard to tell the emotion behind it. If a medium is feeling something, we are a feeling species. So when a medium tells something, there's always emotion behind it. It's relating personal and emotion versus a tech, a camera, a picture. There's also instant feedback. Where we investigate, you have to wait a couple of weeks. A medium can just walk around a location and tell you what they're sensing and what they're seeing and what they're hearing. And it's often, there's also often personal connections that come through where, you know, my equipment isn't going to pick up, you know, the cousin of the owner, you know, saying something, or a parent or a relative or a close friend, where they're not talking into a camera. If the spirit's not talking, I'm not going to have any evidence to show. But a medium, a legitimate medium, can. So that connection that happens, I believe that's where the draw comes from. But it's also where I get questioned on everything, and a lot of times they don't. And I'm perfectly fine with that for the legit ones, but they're not all legit. And it's really hard sometimes to know. It comes back to vetting again. Something else, I've mentioned them before, Grapevine Farms does this incredibly well. There's stuff they don't share with anyone. Where that people have told them. And when somebody comes through and tells them the same thing that someone that has proven themselves has told them, that to them is how they start to decide who they want and who they're going to listen to and who they take seriously. And it's, you know, it's harder to disprove what a medium says, but it's also hard to prove it too. And I think we forget that sometimes. We do take, I love the mediums I know. I love them. They're great people. But at the same time, people just accept what they say instantly, where I have to explain and I have to prove and I have to like tell you, no, that wasn't a car that drove by. it's always made me laugh. And since we're talking about burden of proof, I thought this was the perfect time to bring this up, because if you think about it, it's interesting, and the reasons why are interesting. But they can coexist, and they should coexist. They're both legitimate means of investigating the paranormal and understanding more of what goes on around us that we can't see. And I'm finding more and more locations are starting to do this thing where they're combining the styles. They'll have a group, a tech group like us, and a psychic come in and investigate at the same time. Or like a recent location we just did, they'll have us come in one weekend, and the next weekend they'll have someone else come in who's a medium. And then once they say what they say, then they'll try to put it together with what we capture. And then together we can tell the story. And that's where combining it is absolutely beneficial and pretty amazing when it actually happens. And I always say that I know they're legit when they agree to this. if someone says, you know, I don't work with that, I don't do that, I don't want them around, I'm always like, okay, why not? And But there's a lot of the legit ones, the good ones, the ones that truly, truly have that gift. And they see it as a curse, usually, too. It's not all good. One of our friends once said, you know, Dan, I can't turn this off. It's not a switch. So, yeah, I'm seeing more locations doing it, and it's great. And some have been doing it for a while, and some are catching on. But again, it's the burden of proof. The burden of proof on the investigator, whether they be a medium or whether they be a tech group, it is there. But at the same time, we can't let the fact that it is there affect the process, affect what we find, or affect how we interpret what we find, if we find anything. So while you're chewing on that, we covered a lot there. Just give you some updates on us, Orange County, New York Paranormal. Again, go to our website, orangecountynyparanormal.com. Check us out on Facebook. Check us out on YouTube. Check us out on Instagram. We just shared the evidence with Farmhouse Floral Design from an investigation we did right before the holiday season. So that video is going to come out soon. We're working on that. And we also have another investigation that we're working on that I can't really talk details about at the moment that we just did a couple of weeks ago. If you followed us on Facebook, you may have seen some of those pictures on Instagram as well. And but I do want to share an update that an Orange County, New York paranormal update that will affect what we're doing over the next few months. My wife, Emily, who is the co-founder and one of our lead investigators, she actually had a surgery on a dislocated hip last week. And so she's going to be out a couple of months with that. And that, you know, that'll slow us down a little bit because I don't like to investigate without her. We've been doing this together since day one. And but we do have two investigations in the can, so to speak. Farmhouse Floral Design and this other one. So we're going to be busy and we've got, you know, we're going to pick up actively investigating again in May. And then through the rest of the year, we have everything pretty much booked out. But, you know, in the if you want to throw Emily a well wish in the comment section or the review of the podcast, she'd appreciate that. She always appreciates well wishes. But yeah, she's going to be out for a little while. She's doing well. Surgery went well. But yeah, we're going to be a little shorthanded for the next month or two. And but it's a good time of year. We tend to investigate more in the spring, summer, and fall anyway. So for us, from a timing standpoint, it worked out well. And we're, you know, she's doing really well. We're wishing her a speedy recovery. And we can't wait to get back investigating with her again. So as I said, she'll be allowed medically to investigate again come summertime. All of us, however, are allowed to investigate the paranormal however and whenever we want, regardless of what any YouTube channel out there tells you. The field's crowded, sure, but you can't have enough quality investigators out there, and I hope that's what's come through through this episode. And, you know, the other ones out there that are doing it for the wrong reasons, they're going to be weeded out. As locations are realizing that they have a choice and they can pick and they can choose folks to come in that fit their tastes and needs that match the location and what the location is looking for. And that's great. We can all make each other better. A rising tide raises all boats. And that, my friends, is normal. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time on the Paranormal Podcast.